It's Diane. Great to be back with you. On my mind this week, pipe bombs, heated rhetoric, and President Trump's embrace of the word nationalist. With 11 days left until the midterm elections, I invited NPR's Ron Elving into the studio to hear his take on where the politics of division is taking us as a country.
This particular president is not just pushing the envelope or straining the bounds. He's really quite redefining not only the limits of his own office, but the nature of our democracy and our republic.
Then, former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor announced she has dementia and will be withdrawing from public life. I take a look back to my 2006 interview with the former justice shortly after she stepped down from the bench.
I think there are probably a lot of people, Justice O'Connor, who feel sad that
you've
retired.
Well, I feel sad too, but the time came and that's the decision. It comes sooner or later anyway.
But first, Ron Elving, Washington editor and correspondent for NPR. Ron, it's always good to see you.
Always good to see you, Diane.
So, the midterms are around the corner. This week, bombs sent in the mail. Lots of heated rhetoric and even lies from the president. And the use of the word nationalist. He said, I quote, "I am a nationalist." What does that mean to you?
It means many things, and it's a word that probably should be kept in the language for all of its meanings and not appropriated by any one person. Unfortunately, words that the president takes a liking to oftentimes become associated with him, and that makes it hard for other people to use it without carrying the connotations that he may be giving to that word. Nationalism just means that you see yourself as part of a particular nation that can be either geographical in the sense of the United States or Germany. It can also have the connotation of meaning a nation in a sort of genealogical sense, a biological sense. These are the people from whom I descended. These are my blood relatives, if you will, extended back over many generations and extended out over many families within that given nation. We have spoken for many years about Native American tribes as the Cherokee Nation, the Sioux Nation, and so on. So it has that connotation as well, which can tend in the direction of getting a little bit tribal. Just my people, just the people just like me. And then there is the more American notion of e pluribus unum, one nation from many nations, one nation derived from many genealogies in many different geographical locations that chose, or individuals from which chose to come to the United States and form one nation. And that is pretty much the American definition of our special experiment in world history.
What about the use of the words, white nationalism?
Well, this is one of those nouns that has been tainted by the adjectives that are oftentimes put in front of it. We spoke years ago quite a bit about black nationalism. There was a movement among some African Americans to define themselves somewhat apart and say, look, we have a separate history, we have a separate genealogy, we relate to Africa, not Europe, and there are many reasons for us to think of ourselves as a separate nation. There have been movements on the white nationalist side that are racist in nature and people denying the nationhood of others in America or denying the Americanism of others in America, people thinking we are superior because of our race. And that, of course, has a lengthy and dire history throughout world history, most particularly in Central Europe, in our parents and grandparents' generation, the rise of the Nazi movement, which was white nationalism, Aryanism, not just white, but people who had a certain Nordic blood were considered to be superior, a Teutonic assertion of superiority over everyone. And that, of course, was the essence of the hateful ideology that Adolf Hitler carried to the extraordinary extreme of exterminating people of different religions, Jews in particular, but other religions as well, and exterminating people of other nationalities, gay people, in some cases, people he just didn't like, enemies of the people, including lots of people in journalism. But it really began with this notion of racial purity and a kind of Aryanism that forbade everyone else to either compete, or if they did compete and were in some sense were seen as being adversarial, then they were to be exterminated.
It's so extraordinary in and of itself that the president would use that word now.
Yes.
Why do you think he did?
There is another word that is perfectly available and perfectly acceptable and has not been controversial by and large in our language or our history, and that's patriotism. One can say one is a patriot, a lover of one's own country. And that kind of patriotism, while I'm sure it has some critics and detractors, because it does tend to sometimes ease towards nationalism, that kind of patriotism I think everyone either can or does feel in America and in other countries where people are patriotic about their own country. It's a more benign sense of the word. It's like saying America first. Well, yes, we are Americans. This is our first concern. We're here. We are ourselves. But if America first means America first and everyone else to be in some sense or another denigrated, everyone else to be in some sense or another, well, lorded over by us as America first, that's a very different kind of idea. So the president needs to clarify this. He needs to say what he means. Does he mean he's an economic nationalist, as some people like that phrase? I want to support the United States in trade arrangements. I want to press our case in trade arrangements. That's clearly something that's part of the president's program. Does he mean he's a nationalist in the sense that he wants to close the borders to immigration? Sometimes the president talks about doing that. He's actually talked about closing the southern border, building a wall there, maybe closing the border first and then putting troops on the border. That's a kind of nationalism as well, a kind of economic nationalism that does tend to bleed into a much different kind of nationalism as well. So we need to know more about what the president really has on his mind when he uses that word, but I suspect his first purpose in using it is just to bind himself more closely to voters who respond positively to it.
And indeed they did. I mean, there was lots of cheering. You cannot get inside the president's head. But what do you think he was doing deliberately by using that word?
Well, we use the phrase dog whistle a lot when we talk about politics, and we talk particularly about politicians such as Donald Trump. They say words they know will mean something to people who, in a sense, know better. In fact, the president actually himself said, they told me not to say this, or they say I shouldn't say this word. Well, as soon as you hear him say that, certain people's ears pick up. Well, the media's ears pick up, like, oh, what's he going to say now? But many people who respond to Donald Trump and his, shall we say, populism, shall we say, his bid to the angry, he does seem to actively court the votes of people who feel they have been suppressed in their prejudices, people who feel that political correctness, a phrase that I really, truly detest, but they feel that people who are trying to get us all to show respect and honor each other and our differences are just being, quote, politically correct. And as soon as the president hits that note, as soon as he hits that vein in one of his rallies, the crowd does tend to reach another level of almost animal spirits.
You know, it's almost as though this president has unleashed almost the worst instincts in people's minds that perhaps have been hidden away or suppressed until now. And he has given them permission to act in ways that otherwise would not have been acceptable.
There is a certain legitimizing effect when the president uses a particular kind of language. It's hard, for example, to tell your children not to say a word that the president uses. And it's hard to tell people or to argue with people and say, well, that attitude is outside the bounds or that's not socially acceptable, when the president himself is exhibiting a lot of the same attitude and appealing to it very directly. These rallies that he's having as part of the run-up to the midterms, they're rejuvenating for him. He clearly takes a lot of energy from the crowd. He pitches to the crowd. He pitches down to the crowd. And many people who have covered these all have the same observation. The media people who go and suffer the slings and arrows of the crowd, which in some cases are almost literal, and people making threatening gestures and slitting across their throats with a thumb or a finger. They endure all of that, but they always come back. Many of our people have come back and said, at NPR in particular, I introduce myself to people standing in line to get in the rally. I tell them who I work for. They say, oh, I love NPR, or I love the Washington Post, or I love whatever publication you work for. Or some of them, of course, are hospital. That's always been true. But many people are really quite friendly as they stand in line to go into the Trump rally. Then they have the rally. They all get very excited. They all carry on, as we've all watched. And as they're leaving, they'll stop and hurl some sort of epithet at the media group, which is penned off and further for our own protection at this point, I guess. But in the past, we just thought it was so we'd have some decent seats. And they will either say something nasty or they will have changed their attitude quite totally. And if you try to interview them again, they're much more hostile than they were when you were first walking in. So there does seem to be unleashing that goes on here. Yes, no question. Donald Trump did not invent all these feelings within many Americans. I'm tempted to say the American people, but I don't want to tar everyone. And there is also some instilling. It's not just unleashing. There is also a sense that he is telling people, this is acceptable. You have some of these instincts yourself, and you should be proud of those instincts, and you should release them, act upon them. Your anger is legitimate. Your anger should be expressed in any way you wish.
Is that where you think the animosity toward immigration is coming, and this huge throng of people heading for the states?
It's a perfect symbol. It's a gift, really, to the president in the last weeks before the midterms, because he has wanted to make the midterms about immigration. He's wanted to have it be a referendum on building a wall. We know that Congress is coming back after the election, and I believe it's December 7th that the funding runs out for most of the departments in the federal government, not the military, but for a number of departments, including the Department of Homeland Security, which is in charge of ICE and immigration, and the agency that is on, if you will, the cutting edge of the immigration issue. So the president wants the funding that they vote on December 7th, I believe is the day, if not sooner, to include full funding for the wall. And there is a brand new bill being introduced in the House by the man who might be the next speaker if the Republicans can retain control in the House, Kevin McCarthy, saying, all right, enough with asking for enough to get started. Let's go ahead and appropriate all the money that we need for the entire wall, $25 billion. Let's just make the commitment. Now, I don't see that flying in the Senate, where they're going to need 60 votes to do it. But in the House, it could pass if the Republicans keep control. And that's what the president is really campaigning for. Control of the House, control of the Senate, as many governors as possible, and the wall.
Do you believe his followers accept his statement that the Democrats are behind this procession of immigrants?
The caravan coming from Central America. Many do. And again, the president, by nature of his office, carries a certain amount of authority with many Americans. And this particular president has a highly forceful and effective rhetorical style. And when he tells, we shouldn't start referring to them as his people, but it's tempting. The people who come to the rallies do seem to want to be his people. And when he tells them that these rallies are being organized by some bugaboo of some kind or another, whether it's Venezuela or George Soros or, MS-13 or Al-Qaeda and ISIS, all these names have been mentioned in a sort of just sort of willy-nilly throw out the names of all the great villains of our time, and maybe they're behind it. And at some point or another, maybe the Democrats are behind it. Now, it's a little hard to imagine how it would be politically beneficial to the Democrats to have this particular issue front and center at this moment. I guess the implication is that the Democrats want people to flood across the border and go to the first polling place that they see when they get to California or New Mexico or Arizona and cast votes. If we're into the realm of talking about dire fantasies, I suppose that's what the president is suggesting.
And another, quote, fantasy that he's promulgated is the fact that he says Middle Eastern people have infiltrated this throng.
Yes, and of course, there's no evidence of that whatsoever.
No evidence.
No evidence. They haven't produced a single one. No one says they've seen one. We have reporters. NPR has reporters in Central America, and there's just no indication that there's any reality to that at all. But it fits in the general notion that this can all be villainized. These people are fleeing violence. They're fleeing extortion gangs that in some cases have killed some of their family members and are coming after them. They're fleeing, of course, poverty and all the conditions that have obtained there for a long time, but they're fleeing a specific infestation of gang violence in their country. That is maybe not going to be a cause for asylum, or they may not be granted asylum on that basis. We have had a mixed history of that in terms of asylum seekers. But they are not coming here as part, it's certainly not a lark, and they are not coming here as part of somebody's political campaign to achieve some political end in the United States. They may be exploited by all kinds of political figures for those figures' political gain. But their intention, when they took off on this journey, was to make it to the United States and try to make a new life here, just like other immigrants have always done.
And the president says he's going to send U.S. troops to the border to prevent anyone from crossing the border. How many troops would he need to actually defend the entire border?
Well, it's from California to the Gulf of Mexico. I believe it's around 1,200 miles, something of that nature. 800 troops, of course, are not even going to make it to one troop per mile. This has always been the problem. It's very long. There are some extremely remote areas. Even the wall may not actually have to be in every place if it were to be built because some of these areas are so rugged and remote. So it's a show. 800 people is not a particularly large force. Any number of troops would obviously be a very effective group against these migrants, largely families, many women, many children. They are not, as far as anyone's established, armed in any way, let alone the kind of arms they would need to contest with an American military unit. So it's for show to say, we are not going to let these people in, and we're going to discourage all future migrants, caravan or otherwise, from thinking they can come to the United States for asylum. And it's a show of a kind of bravado, attempting to use the word macho, to say, we have guns and you're not welcome.
Ron, let's talk about these bombs and the threats to news organizations. CNN was among the first to receive one of the bombs, not a particular favorite of President Trump. In fact, none of the people who've thus far received these bomb threats and bombs has been a favorite of President Trump. What do you make of this effort to terrorize the country?
It is that. It is an attempt to intimidate people and make people feel afraid for their lives if they are seen as a nemesis to this president, or so it would appear. Now, until we know who actually sent these bombs, until we actually know what they were up to, we can't really say if this is some sort of false flag operation, which some people are alleging as though they knew, and we can't say if it's some part of some larger organization or if it's just one very busy crackpot murderous person, such as the Unabomber in another era, who did a lot of damage. This has not yet hurt anyone, but of course it does have a terrifying effect on those people who can imagine they might receive one, or those people who might be unwittingly exposed to one of these devices, either by working at a post office or by being somewhere near where they're being transported. We still don't know what the deadliness level of them is. They do appear to be serious, but we don't really know how professionally done they were. And so there are so many question marks that it's hard to know what the specific motivation of this bomber might have been. However, it's impossible not to notice that this is an almost who's who list of the nemeses of the president, his rivals for power in the opposite party, and some critics in the media, although really not very many, just CNN, as far as I know, have been actually bomb targets. But the implication is there for others in the media. And then some senators and members of Congress. And then people like John Brennan, the former CIA director, and James Clapper, the former director of National Intelligence, who have been outspoken critics of the president, to be sure, but who are scarcely, well, they are as responsible a figure in our intelligence community as you can find, and have been for decades.
At first, President Trump said, now we must be calm, we must not let fear intimidate us. And then he moved into a whole nother dialogue saying, it's the media's fault. I'm speechless.
There are times when the president plays the role of the president, as he has doubtless been endlessly advised the country expects him to do, including those people who are angry, those people who love Donald Trump. They also expect him to at least have presidential moments in the sense that we have previously understood a presidential moment, to be a leader of the country as a whole, to be a person who is a force for a calm, as you say, and for rapprochement between different antagonists, somebody who tries to bring the country together in every crisis. Leading, yes, but keeping in mind that the whole country needs to be kept together in some sense. That's what we call presidential. I'm not saying every president has always met that mark, but they have all felt the necessity of at least trying, and they have felt the sting of the punishment of the people when they have failed to fulfill the presidential obligation. This president occasionally takes a pass at it, as you just described. He says the right thing for a few minutes, but then he pivots with a particular kind of smile on his face and tells you what he really wants to say, apparently, which is less presidential, and which puts the blame on others, and particularly puts it on messengers, people who are trying to, among other things, show the country the country's president, put him on television almost constantly, but also with journalism, also with reporting on the facts, also with reporting on other people who see things differently. And that seems to enrage him, so much so that he is willing to blame the media, journalism, critics, for the actions of a bomber, a serial, perhaps, bomber.
Does that not take your breath away as well?
I have had my breath taken away rather frequently in the last 3 years, and I think we all have to say we've been humbled by the degree to which things we thought could not happen, were not possible in America, are clearly possible and are happening in America. And this particular president is not just pushing the envelope or straining the bounds, he's really quite redefining not only the limits of his own office, but the nature of our democracy and our republic. And I think we all need to take a hard look at that and consider what our reaction to that is and how we can adopt behaviors on our own that are different from his, that are the behaviors that we think we should see in a president, the behaviors that we should see in a good citizen, and whatever that may entail, certainly voting, certainly taking part in public discourse, being part of the system, not walking away and say, oh, politics, they're all the same, I don't care, never makes any difference, don't call on me. And we can't do that anymore. We have to be active citizens.
What about the reactions of both Republicans and Democrats? What have you seen?
Of course, everyone condemns the bombs. Everyone condemns the worst of the rhetoric. Everyone condemns the division, the divisiveness, the tribalism that we see arising in our politics. But then the question becomes, what are you going to do to change the direction that we seem to be headed in? What is an appropriate role for you as a Republican or as a Democrat? What is the proper role for you as a senator, a member of Congress, a person in public life, or a citizen, certainly a person in the media? How do you respond to this particular challenge, which in American life, not in the history of the world, but in American life, does seem rather unprecedented? We have had strong presidents in wartime. Abraham Lincoln did a lot of things that were repressive, suspended habeas corpus rights in some places. And so we have had strong presidents in wartime. We have had strong presidents in extreme depression, such as Franklin Roosevelt, who did things many conservatives felt were outside the bounds of his office. We've had that kind of controversy. We have to measure the current moment against those moments. Ask, what were the circumstances then? What justified the president then, if you see him as justified? Are those circumstances present today? What are the ultimate objectives and purposes of this presidential behavior? What's he trying to do, and how should we as citizens react?
Another thing he told his supporters was that he was going to lower taxes by another 10% in the next few weeks. Now, I would think his supporters know that Congress is out of session until after the election, that this president, no matter how powerful he is, cannot do such a thing on his own. Why would he say that?
It's been interesting to me to see how people, for example, in West Virginia, when you ask them, do you believe that coal is coming back as a central part of our energy supply? Do you think those coal mines are all going to reopen now that President Trump has become president? And they say, no, probably not. People are moving on. They're using natural gas. They're using other things. They have a great deal of sophistication about what happened to coal. When you say, well, doesn't that disappoint you when the president promised he was going to reopen the mines and put all the miners back to work? And they say, we didn't really think he could do that, but we appreciated that someone was willing to come to West Virginia and tell us that's what he wanted to do and care enough about us and our way of life and the way we have already always seen ourselves as self-sufficient because of our way of life, cared enough about that and us to come and say that to us, even though it's probably outside his power to actually change the history of energy use in America. He can't do that by fiat when everybody wants to use something cheaper and cleaner. And that's an, I think, interesting illustration, because the president is aware that he doesn't have to deliver on a lot of these things as long as he maintains the belief that he is working towards those things, that he would do them if he could do it by fiat. He would wave the wand if there were a wand, and he would make everything right again in the minds of those who think it was right at some point in the past, so that that would be making America great again. And as long as people believe that that's his goal, he's their champion. He does not have to deliver another 10% tax cut this month, next month, the month after that. He has signaled to them that he wants to do that. He wants to give them more money back in their pocket. Vote for me. I'll cut your taxes.
This belief, despite reality, is fascinating because it indicates that Donald Trump exerts a kind of power over the minds of some people that goes beyond any reality that could possibly be there. Now, I find that fascinating.
It is, I think, fascinating and extraordinary, and I think it's come as a surprise even to Donald Trump, that the issues that he chose, the manner he chose to pursue them, the way he wars with the media, the way he wars with the elite in both parties, the way he wars with the rich. Now, he himself is very proud of saying he's a billionaire. And he's
self-made.
Very self-made, he likes to also say. We know that's not true. We aren't even sure he is actually, in the last analysis, a net worth billionaire. But he also likes to pose himself against the perceptions of the rich, even though one would have to say that a Manhattan tycoon living on top of Trump Tower was in some sense a perfect plutocrat, he can portray himself as being against Wall Street or against the Federal Reserve Board or against the banks or against some definition of the elite that essentially boils down to people that I don't like. And for many voters, even if they see through, if you will, the act, the embodiment of the myth for him means the myth is in some sense embodied for them, and the myth of the world as you would like it to be takes on a certain amount of reality, and he's the salesman, and they love the salesman.
They simply love the salesman, and what he represents for them may be sort of like imagining that they're going to win the lottery, which all of us do.
When the lottery has found that you sell more tickets, the larger the amount becomes, which means that the odds of anyone winning it are that much smaller as more tickets are sold. So there's your perfect example. As you say, as more tickets are sold, your chance of winning lessens. It decreases. So more and more people go out and buy those tickets anyway because they're mesmerized by that enormous billion-dollar figure. I think that someone is going to spend a little time on all of this and come up with a pretty interesting metaphor and a pretty interesting psychological breakdown of those two sets of beliefs. The if we just believe it enough, it'll be true, or at least it'll feel better to believe it, on the one hand, and the phenomenon of people buying more and more tickets for the lottery as their chance of winning goes down.
Ron, the news is moving so quickly. Even as we are speaking Friday morning, we've just learned there has been an arrest made in the bombing cases.
That's right, a man in Florida in his 50s, and that is all we know at this point. So it really answers very few questions, but it is a relief, I think, to many people to at least have some indication that the source of these bombs might be apprehended. And we don't know if it's the only person involved.
Indeed. Ron Elving, always good to talk with you.
Always a delight to be with you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now a quick break. When I return, an excerpt of my 2006 interview with former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District,
Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Sandra Day O'Connor was appointed to the Supreme Court by Ronald Reagan back in 1981, the first woman to sit on the bench. She stepped down in 2006 in order to take care of her husband, who was suffering from Alzheimer's disease. This week, she announced in a letter that she herself has dementia and is withdrawing from public life. Here's an excerpt from her June 2006 appearance on The Diane Rehm Show. Welcome to you, Justice O'Connor. It's so good to see you.
Thank you, Diane. I'm glad to be here and to see you.
Thank you. Tell me how concerned you are about the independence of the judicial branch of our government.
I am concerned. I've lived a pretty long time now, and in my lifetime, I don't believe I've seen as many complaints by members of Congress, by state legislators, by other officials, and even by the public about judges. We're hearing statements rather frequently, I think, complaining that judges are activists, godless, secular humanists trying to impose some new regime on the nation. And I just don't see it that way. I understand that sometimes judges have to resolve very controversial issues, sometimes in cases where good arguments can be made on either side of the issue. And it's understandable that sometimes people disagree about the right answer. But efforts to retaliate against judges for their judicial decision-making worries me very much, because the basis of our constitutional structure that the framers designed envisioned three independent branches of government: the executive, headed by the president, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch. The framers went to great effort to try to provide independence for federal judges anyway, and states have followed the same pattern in the design of state governments. James Madison, we think of as the father of our Constitution, he did much of the thinking and drafting that went into our Constitution. And he said that an independent judiciary is an impenetrable bulwark against every assumption of power in the legislative or the executive. Now, that's putting it a little strongly, but what I think Madison was trying to express is that the courts are important guardians of the guaranteed freedoms in our Constitution.
Do you believe that you retired at the right time?
There's no right time. In my case, I was concerned about caring for a husband of many years who has some medical problems and needed a great deal more of my attention. And I wasn't timing it for anything else than that.
I think there are probably a lot of people, Justice O'Connor, who feel sad that
you've
retired.
Well, I feel sad too, but the time came and that's the decision. It comes sooner or later anyway. I have a wonderful poem. I should have brought it. But it describes how you may think you're indispensable, but it's a little like putting your hand in a bucket of water and stirring it around. And it makes a big splash at the time, but when you pull your hand out, the water settles down and it's absolutely undisturbed. So I hope that in the long run will be the effect of my departure.
Justice O'Connor, thank you so much for joining us. I look forward to seeing you again.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you. You can find the full interview with Sandra Day O'Connor on DianeRehm.org, along with two other conversations I had with Justice O'Connor over the years. And that's all for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, and go to our website, DianeRehm.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Natalie Urib-Lipker and Ben Priffitt. And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.